Book of Revelation is divided, as we've seen, into three parts. We have this inspired outline in Revelation chapter 1:19, where John is told, write the things you've seen, and then it says, write the things which are, and then write the things after these things. And chapter 1, as we have observed, is the things that John had seen. It was that vision that he gave, was given on the island of Patmos, of the radiant resurrected Christ. So chapter 1, verses 9 through 20, John has written down the things that he's seen. Now in chapter 2, we come to the next of these main sections in the outline of the book. And this is what I call the things which are. It's the letters to these seven churches. Back in chapter 1 and verse 10, we're given the addressees here that John is writing to these seven churches. Actually, up in chapter 1, verse 4, it says John to the seven churches in Asia. But then in chapter 1, verse 11, they're identified as Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And you can see here on a map, I've got a couple of maps here, but you can see there the city of Ephesus right on the coast, and it goes up to Smyrna, then Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, over to Laodicea. These are seven literal churches that existed back in the first century AD that Jesus wrote to here, that he addressed these letters to. It's the western part of modern-day Turkey. And when you think about these seven churches that he writes to here in these two chapters, there's a few issues kind of to discuss up front before we get into the letters themselves. And there's so much in these seven letters, you can really spend an hour or a couple of hours on each letter very easily. A lot of detail packed into these messages. But again, we're just going to kind of look at the overview of the seven churches, look at maybe a few of the issues related to them, and a few practical points for us as we go through these two chapters. But the first thing I thought we would just ask ourselves, a very basic question: why seven churches? Why isn't the letters to the eight churches of Asia Minor, letter to the 10 churches or the five churches? Well, I think the reason that there's seven churches addressed here, again, seven is a key number in the book of Revelation. 54 times you have this number seven that appears. And I think that the seven churches gives us kind of the idea that this is the fullness or the perfection here. This is the complete number. So there's something within these seven churches that gives us kind of a complete or a full view of the church. So I think that's why there's seven of them. Now, a second question that comes up is, well, why these seven? You know, there's all kinds of churches that could have been addressed by Jesus. There are about 30 local churches mentioned in the New Testament. You think about a lot of these churches, the church at Colossae, the church of Hierapolis, the church of Thessalonica, the church at Philippi, the church at Corinth. A lot of local churches mentioned in the New Testament. So why these seven? Well, I think there's probably a couple reasons for that. One is, remember John, when he's writing these letters, he is banished to the island of Patmos, about 40 miles off the coast of the city of Ephesus. And John, from about the time of the mid-60s, when he moved from Israel to that area, John has been probably the overseer, kind of the shepherd of all the churches in and around the area of Ephesus, these churches in Asia Minor. He's the last living apostle, and he's had great authority with these churches. So these were churches that he was familiar with. I think that's probably why these seven are selected. Also, another reason I think for these seven is these seven are representative of the kinds of churches that will always exist during church history. God in His omniscience knows that these seven churches will give us a pretty full-orbed view of what the church will be like, of what churches will be like on the earth. So God knows that, and He selects these seven. One other issue with these churches, just kind of as an introductory way, is why this order? Why is it Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea? Probably the reason for that is this was the order in that day of the ancient postal route or the postal system. So when mail was brought primarily to Ephesus, being the great port city, it would be taken and dropped off there, and then a postman going on the route would go in this order to the various cities. So what we see here, I think, in this is that these seven angels to the seven churches, that you remember, I take those to be human messengers, maybe leaders of these churches, These men come and they each receive a copy of the book of Revelation. They write a copy of that and they take it back one by one to these churches. So my view is all seven of them land at Ephesus. And they leave the letter behind and the leader behind at Ephesus, and the other six go on to Smyrna. And they leave the elder or the leader, the pastor behind there with his copy, and the other five then go on to Pergamum and so on till all these letters have been delivered. They're delivering these letters and they're reading them. They're allowed in the churches. So here's another map here that just shows where Patmos is off the coast, then Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, the order of these churches to which they were would have been delivered. Now, one other big issue in the letters of the seven churches is what is the significance of these seven letters? People have seen a lot of different significance to these seven epistles that were written by the resurrected Christ. Almost everybody sees a practical significance to these letters. That is, these letters are seven letters to seven literal historical churches that existed at the end of the first century in the cities mentioned. So there was a practical significance to these churches. And as we go through these, we want to interpret these letters in their original context to the original audience. So it was written to these churches as a message to them. But secondly, then there's what I would call a perennial significance of these letters, which is they represent all the different kinds of churches that will exist simultaneously through church history. For instance, today in Edmond, Oklahoma, or in Oklahoma City where I live, I would say that you could probably find most of these kinds of churches in this area. Now, you may not find Smyrna churches because in Oklahoma we don't undergo a lot of persecution. But if you look worldwide at the church, we find churches that are like all these seven churches existing simultaneously at any time in church history. So what we can do as we read these letters to the churches is we can read these and we can identify the things in our churches today that are like what was going on in these churches. So there's a practical significance to the original audience. There's a perennial significance of these letters to churches throughout church history. But then there's a third view that some people hold, and that is that these seven letters have prophetic significance. And what they mean by that is they would say that these seven letters represent seven stages of church history. And generally the way that they would lay that out is they would say this is a prophetic history of the church since there's seven of them and seven is the number of completion. This is meant to give us a panorama view of church history. And they would usually say it like this. Ephesus is the apostolic era. It pictures the early church from like AD 33 to AD 64. Smyrna, then, the second church, is a persecuted church. That's the period of persecution in the church from 64 AD to about 313 AD. Then with Pergamum, you have the era of the official kind of patronage of the church when the church and the world became married from about 313 to 606. Then Thyatira pictures the church of the Middle Ages. Sardis pictures the time of the Protestant Reformation when the church was dead and was called on then to be alive. The Church of Philadelphia, they would say, pictures the missionary era when the gospel went out and God gave to the churches an open door of ministry. And then Laodicea, they would say, pictures the church of the modern era, you know, lukewarm and kind of tepid and, you know, not really very engaged and not doing powerful things for the Lord. Now, that's an attractive view. I mean, it looks kind of nice. It'll preach well. You can say, man, these churches, you know, they picture these stages of church history. And then you can say, we're in the Laodicean stage or this lukewarm stage. And so the Lord is about to come back. So it'll preach well. But there's four reasons why I reject that third idea of how these churches are used. First of all, this is a very important point. It's a simple point, but an important one. Nothing in the text indicates these seven churches represent seven stages of church history. Now, that's a very basic point, but you have to read that into the text. It doesn't arise from the text. You don't read the text and say, oh, I can see how these are seven stages of church history. To me, it's something you have to read into the text. And again, our job is to let the text speak to us, to read and to derive the meaning from the text, not for us to read into it. Secondly, there's not really a clear-cut accepted way to divide church history into seven distinct stages. A lot of different ways people do this. Here's another point, and this is something I think is important for all of us to remember. This doesn't fit the global church. It only fits Western Christianity. You think about, people will say, well, now we're in the Laodicean stage of the church where everybody's rich and wealthy and self-sufficient and has need of nothing. I always like to say, go tell people in Haiti that who are believers, or go tell people in Cambodia that, or go tell believers who are in North Korea that, or in some parts of the Middle East. That's a very Western, very parochial view of church history. It's just viewing it from the Western perspective. And the final reason I reject that view is it destroys imminency. If all these seven stages had to go through of church history before the Lord can come back, well, then Jesus can't come back at any time, which I think the New Testament would give us this idea that Christ can return at any time. So I think it destroys the idea there of imminency. So the seven churches, I see these letters as written to seven literal local churches in that day to describe the conditions they face, to tell them how to live. There's also this ongoing perennial significance to all churches living at all times in church history. But I don't see any kind of a prophetic template or anything like that in these seven churches. Now, when we come to the letters of the seven churches, they follow a basic pattern these seven letters do. They open with the commission or the church. Every one of them began, to the angel of the church in Ephesus, right? It describes the angel and then the location. And then the second thing you have there is what I call the correspondent or the Christ. In every one of these letters, there's a self-description of Jesus. For instance, at Ephesus, he says, the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand, the one who walks among the seven golden lampstands says this. In almost all of these self-descriptions of Jesus, except one, are an allusion back to chapter 1 where we had this vision of the resurrected radiant Christ. So he's picking up on some aspect of how he's described in chapter 1 and carrying that over to the letter. And the way Jesus describes himself in each one of these letters is of special importance. That description of himself is to that church. That's how they need to see him. Then he goes on, there's a commendation to the church where he commends them for some good things they're doing. That's in all of the letters except Laodicea. Laodicea, Jesus has nothing good to say about that church. That's a sobering thing. Then there's a complaint where Jesus has some complaint or concern with the church. That's in all of the churches except Smyrna and Philadelphia. Those two, nothing negative is said. So, one of the seven, nothing good said about, and two of the seven, nothing bad is said about. And then the letters, the ones at least that have a concern or a complaint, then there's a correction that's given. And then there's a call to him who has ears, who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And I like that. He always just says, he who has an ear, let him hear. All you got to have is just one ear. That's how you got to have ears. So you got to just have one ear to hear. And then there's a comfort. In all of these letters, he makes a promise to the overcomer. Every one of them, there's this promise. To him who overcomes, I will give to the tree of life or whatever. And I take it there that all those promises to the overcomer is to believers in general. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Here's the seven churches, though I've got this chart up here for you to see, just to kind of give a description. I like to alliterate things so I can remember it, but Ephesus, I call the loveless church. Smyrna was the loyal church. Pergamum is the lax church. Thyatira, I would call the liberal church. Sardis is the lifeless church. Philadelphia was the laboring church. And Laodicea is the lukewarm church. You kind of have a pretty good overview there of the kind of churches that existed then and exist today as well. Well, the first one of these churches is the church at Ephesus, and Ephesus is a magnificent city. I've got a few slides here to show a few pictures. They worshiped Artemis. Remember Artemis of the Ephesians? They believed that some meteorite or something that fell from heaven was Artemis, and they took that and they placed it inside the temple they built to her. But all these statues and trinkets were built to Artemis, and one of the seven wonders of the ancient world was a building called the Artemisian, or the temple to Artemis. And the Artemisian was 425 feet long, 225 feet wide, and 60 feet high. If any of you have ever seen the Parthenon in Athens, the Temple of Artemis was four times the size of the Parthenon. It's a huge, massive building. The largest building in antiquity, the largest marble temple that was ever constructed. It really was an unbelievably beautiful building that was there. And of course, Ephesus was the hub of Asia Minor, one of the three most important cities of that day, about 250,000 people in population. But when Jesus writes to this church, he says to them, and Jesus says this to all the churches but one, "I know your deeds and your toil and your perseverance, and that you cannot endure evil men, and you put to test those who call themselves apostles and they're not, and you found them to be false. And you have perseverance, and you've endured for my name's sake, and you have not grown weary." I mean, this is a church that's a beehive of activity. These people are discerning. They put people to the test who teach false doctrine. They persevere in his name. This place is a discerning, dedicated group of people. Now, one of the things about the church of Ephesus we need to remember, eight books in the New Testament were written to the church at Ephesus. I don't know if you've ever thought about that before, but more letters or more books were written to that place than any other. You have John's Gospel that was written by John, probably to people in and around that area. Then you have, of course, the book of Ephesians. Then you have 1st and 2nd Timothy written to Timothy, probably while he's pastoring there. Then you have 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John written by John to the network of house churches in that area. And then you have the book of Revelation. One of the churches it's addressed to is Ephesus. So this is a very important church. And remember that this church had Paul there ministering for 3 years. Then Timothy was there as the pastor. Apollos was there. Aquila and Priscilla were there. And then to cap things off, John came there and made that the headquarters of his ministry. So you talk about a church that had the who's who of pastors in their history. This is a church with an incredible heritage and a legacy. So they know how to discern doctrine. They're busy. They're dedicated for the Lord. But notice in verse 4, this sudden transition. "But I have this against you. You have left your first love." So there's something that's wrong in this church in spite of all of the other things that they have there. The church in Ephesus had been in existence now for about 40 years, founded during Paul's third missionary journey. It's now been about 40 years. One thing that's fascinating is, I don't want to take too long on this, but right at the very end of the book of Ephesians, the very last verse of Ephesians says this, "Grace be with all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ with a love incorruptible." Isn't that fascinating? The very end of this letter, Ephesians, probably written in about 62 AD, he says, "Grace be with all those who love the Lord Jesus with a love that's an incorruptible love." Many people believe that love is actually the theme of the book of Ephesians. In fact, Harold Honer, in his unbelievable commentary on the book of Ephesians, believes that that is the key word in the book of Ephesians. So right at the end of the letter, he says, "You all love Jesus with an incorruptible love." Now you come over 30 years later, and here they are. He says, "I have this against you. You have lost your first love." They don't love Jesus the way they did back in the beginning. One of the things that's interesting, if you visit the city of Ephesus, when you visit there today, there's a street called Harbor Street. And the Harbor Street goes out, and it was right where the water came to back in the ancient city. Well, you go there now, and the edge of the harbor is 5 miles away now. It's all silted up there. The whole harbor is silted up. That's why the city of Ephesus died ultimately, is because their harbor silted up and they kept dredging it, and it just the city was extended so far out. But now you have to go 5 miles from the end of the Harbor Street to get to the ocean. So the whole harbor was silted up, and someone has given the illustration that just as the harbor of their city had silted up, the hearts of the people had silted up over time. And they'd lost their first love for Jesus Christ. There's a very important lesson here in this passage, and it's this. You can be active for the Lord. You can have discernment. You can be straight theologically and all of that, but you cannot be in love with Jesus Christ. It's like old Vance Havner used to say, you can be as straight as a gun barrel theologically and as cold as a gun barrel spiritually. That's the way a lot of people are. But God doesn't want us to be this way. He wants us to love Him passionately with the love we had at first. And then he says in verse 6 here, he does commend him though here at the end. He says, you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Now we don't know for sure who the Nicolaitans were. We're going to see them a little bit when we get over to the letter to the church at Pergamum. But evidently from church history, they may have been followers of a man named Nicholas. Back in Acts chapter 6, one of the seven men there selected with Stephen and Philip. And one of the men in the early church tells us that Nicholas, the Nicolaitans were the follower of Nicholas, which means if that's true, he became an apostate. But we do know from the letter of the church at Pergamum that they promoted false doctrine and they promoted sexual immorality. But he congratulates the believers there at Ephesus for the fact that they hated the deeds of the Nicolaitans. And notice Jesus says, which I also hate. So there are things that Jesus hates. Jesus hates wrong doctrine and false teaching. Now in verse 7, he says, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Notice again, all of these letters are for all the churches. So each letter is to all the churches. As this book was read out loud, it was a message to all of them. It says, to him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life in the paradise of God. Now, when he talks here about the overcomer, there's two views of that. Some would say the overcomers here are special Christians who live kind of above the ordinary. The problem with that is many of the promises that are made in these letters to the overcomers have to apply to every Christian. I mean, right here he says, if you're an overcomer, you can eat from the tree of life in the paradise of God. Well, that can't be a special promise to Christians. All believers will have that. In the church at Sardis, he says, the one who overcomes, I won't erase his name from the book of life. Well, that's true of all believers. Our names won't be erased from the book of life. So I take it these are all believers. Because remember in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 4, John says this, the same author who writes this, he says, this is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. So the overcomer is the one who has faith in Jesus Christ. This is a word we'll see often in the book of Revelation, the word overcomer. It's from the Greek verb there, nikao. We get our word Nike or Nike from that, the goddess of victory. And so this is where we get the word for the Nike sports company. But the overcomer is the true believer in Jesus Christ. So these rewards that are mentioned at the end of each of these churches are rewards that are for all believers. A couple things here to mention about this is, first of all, the church is a lampstand. It's not the lamp. We need to remember that. Each of these churches are the lampstand. We're not the lamp. The lamp is the truth that we hold forth. A second thing here to notice is it says, I know your deeds, Jesus says. Jesus knows what we do. He knows what we do in our churches. He knows what we do individually. Six of the seven churches, Jesus says, I know your deeds. The third lesson here is correctness of doctrine does not necessarily indicate a heart for God. Just because you have right doctrine and you dot all the I's and you cross all the T's does not mean that you have a heart for God. Sadly, a lot of people that know a lot become puffed up in their knowledge and they lose their love for Christ. And the fourth lesson I would see here is departure from our first love is seen in failure to love others. We see that back in 1 John. So that's the letter to the church at Ephesus. The next church is the church of Smyrna. This is what we might call the suffering church or the laboring church. And I don't want to go through each of the letters in great detail, but we can suffice it to say that this was a church that was undergoing suffering. And Polycarp, you remember, was from Smyrna. Polycarp was martyred there in about 155, 166 AD. And so this represents the churches today that suffer in various parts of the world, the suffering church that is called to endure. The next church that's mentioned is the church at Pergamum. And this is the compromising church. They had compromised because, remember, the church at Ephesus hated the deeds of the Nicolaitans, whereas the church at Pergamum, it tells us, they were holding to the teaching of the Nicolaitans. And the teaching of the Nicolaitans was evidently something that told people it was okay to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit acts of immorality. So some type of a libertine teaching that was causing people to compromise with the world. One thing about the city of Pergamum that's interesting, I want to point out here, is he says to the church at Pergamum in verse 13, he says, "I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is." And then notice the end of verse 13, it says, "You live where Satan dwells." Now, what does that mean, where Satan dwells? And he mentions where Satan has his throne, he mentions here in this passage. He says, "I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is." By the way, one thing I'll mention here that's fascinating, with the other seven churches, Jesus says of all of them, "I know your deeds." But notice with this church, he says, "I know where you live. I know where you dwell." Evidently, Pergamum was what we might call hell's headquarters. Satan had set up shop there in a unique way. And I think if we know anything about the imagery there, Pergamum was a city that was filled with temples, idol temples. And so in that sense, I think Satan uniquely dwelled there in that city. But I love this that John says to them, "I know where you live. I know where you live there in this city of Pergamum." And I just say this as a devotional thought. Jesus would say to every one of us, "I know where you live." He knows where we live. He knows the difficulties you have, maybe the struggles you have, maybe in your home or your marriage or whatever your background is. Jesus knows where you live. And to me, that ought to be a comfort to each one of us. The other churches, he says, "I know your deeds." But here he tells them, "I know where you dwell." Well, there's a lot of different ideas about what Satan's throne is. Some believe it's the carved out theater in the side of the hillside you can see in the picture there. Some believe it's the altar of Zeus that sat there up on the city of Pergamum. It's one of the splendid things you can ever see. It's actually in the Pergamum Museum today. The Germans took it apart and took it to Germany and reconstructed it there. It's a stunning sight. Overlooked the whole valley and the whole area there. But the practical lesson for us from the church of Pergamum is the church at Pergamum can be compared to the modern church today, tempted to compromise and conform in the midst of the pressures of a secular world and a world that's filled with false teaching. The same thing those churches faced then, it's the same thing churches face today. We're tempted to not love Christ like we should. We may suffer persecution in some parts of the world. The church at Pergamum, the temptation to compromise what we believe in Jesus Christ. So these churches really are so applicable. It's kind of the more things have changed over time, the more they've stayed the same. Very relevant to our lives today. Well, next time we want to pick up with the church of Thyatira, the church that was known for its tolerance. If there's one buzzword for our culture today, it's the word tolerance. And there's a good kind of tolerance and there's a bad kind of tolerance. We'll pick up next time as we continue this study in the seven churches with the church of Thyatira.